VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the World Health Organization says COVID-19 has interfered with necessary health services in almost every country. It says low- and middle-income nations are affected the most by the crisis. In May, WHO officials sent a list of questions about the crisis to health officials in 159 countries. Officials in 105 countries answered over the next 3 months. The WHO says 90% of them reported at least some interference in at least one of 25 necessary services. More than 50% reported interference with the ability to find and treat cancer. Malaria programs were affected in almost half of the countries. Tuberculosis programs were affected in more than 40% of countries, and HIV treatment in 33%. Almost half of low-income countries reported interference in at least 75% of their necessary health services. 4% of high-income countries reported this level of interference. The services most commonly affected were immunization programs, with interference reported in 70% of the 105 countries. Identification and treatment of diseases that do not spread person to person, such as diabetes, were affected in 69% of countries. Family planning services were affected in 68%, and mental health treatment services in 61% of reporting countries. Interference in critical emergency services were reported in about 25% of the countries that answered the questions. The great majority of interference reported affected between 5 and 50% of services. A WHO statement said that even strong health systems can be quickly weakened by the spread of COVID-19. North America, South America, and countries in the Caribbean were not included in the WHO research. The organization said this was because of the high rates of coronavirus spread and limited capacities in those areas at the time of the study. The new information is the most detailed examination of the effects of the COVID-19 crisis on health services. Interference in most HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria programs in low-income countries supported by the Global Fund have been reported. One study estimated that deaths from HIV over the next 5 years could increase by 10% as a result. It said that tuberculosis deaths might rise by 20% and malaria by 36%. The WHO report says countries are beginning to make changes to how they operate health services. Telemedicine, professional health care provided over a computer or phone, is on the rise. And about half of countries have found new ways to get medicine to patients. Efforts to document and learn from what works in different settings are urgently required, the report said.
The United States military says China will increase the size of its nuclear arms supply by at least 100% over the next 10 years. The Department of Defense made the prediction in a yearly report to Congress called China Military Power. The report was released on Tuesday. It says China's plan to modernize and expand its nuclear force is part of a larger effort to equal and, in some cases, pass the U.S. military by 2049 as the leading power in the Indo-Pacific area. The report says China is thought to have more than 200 nuclear bombs. They are said to include nuclear warheads that can be fitted on missiles that can reach the United States. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Chad Sabraja spoke to reporters about the report. He said the military's leadership is concerned about the number of bombs, but also just the trajectory of China's nuclear developments writ large. The United States nuclear supply, with its estimated 3,800 active nuclear warheads, remains much larger than China's. The U.S. has submarines, airplanes, and long-distance missiles that can carry out nuclear strikes. China lacks the ability to launch nuclear weapons from the air. However, the new report notes that the Chinese military announced late last year it had an air-to-air refueling airplane, one equipped to carry such weapons. In the past 15 years, the Chinese Navy has built 12 nuclear submarines, the report noted. Six of them can be used as sea-based nuclear deterrents. By the middle 2020s, the report said, China will likely build a new guided missile nuclear attack submarine. It could carry out a secret land attack if equipped with the right missiles. China has rejected pressure from the Trump administration to join the U.S. and Russia in a deal to limit nuclear arms. If China does not join the treaty, known as the New START, the U.S. might let the deal expire in February of 2021. Last week, U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper warned that the world's free and open system was under attack by what he called China's rule-breaking behavior in the Indo-Pacific area. Esper called the Indo-Pacific area the epicenter of great power competition. He promised that the United States would not surrender an inch to countries that threaten international freedoms. I'm Katie Weaver.
American billionaire Elon Musk has demonstrated a technology designed to use a computer chip inside the head to control the brain. During a video demonstration on Friday, Musk provided details about the system, called Neuralink. In addition to leading the Neuralink startup, Musk also heads electric car maker Tesla and U.S. space company SpaceX. Musk says he hopes the technology can be used to treat neural disorders and help spinal injury victims regain body movement. Musk also believes the system could be used in the future to improve intelligence to help humans keep up with supercomputers and artificial intelligence technology. During the demonstration, Musk showed off a model of the Neuralink device. It is about 23 millimeters wide. It is designed to be implanted into a person's skull. Small wires would connect the device directly to the brain. The Neuralink system is currently being tested in pigs, with plans to seek government approval for human testing sometime in the future. Neuralink's head surgeon, Dr. Matthew McDougall, said the company's first human tests would involve a small number of people. The tests would be aimed at treating individuals suffering from paralysis, a condition that makes someone unable to move or feel all or part of their body. During the demonstration, Musk showed off a pig named Gertrude. He explained that Gertrude had a Neuralink implant inside its head. The device is meant to record nerve activity in the pig's nose and mouth. Musk said the company had three pigs, each with two implants. He described the animals as healthy, happy, and indistinguishable from a normal pig. Musk said the company was able to predict with high accuracy a pig's leg movement on a running machine using data from the implant. Musk used the event to invite engineers and other experts to join the company in developing the technology. He also urged people to develop their own devices and bring them to Neuralink. "You don't need to have brain experience," Musk noted. "Those skills can be learned on the job," he said. Linking a brain directly to electronics is not new. Doctors implant electrodes in brains to deliver signals to treat conditions such as Parkinson's disease, epilepsy, and pain. In experiments, implanted sensors have let paralyzed people use brain signals to operate computers and move robotic arms. In 2016, researchers reported that a man regained some movement in his own hand with a brain implant. Musk's Neuralink hopes to one day offer operations to improve brain performance, the Wall Street Journal reported when the company launched. Musk noted that Neuralink first wants to use the device on people with severe spinal cord injuries to help them talk and move using their brain waves. He said he is hopeful that in the long term, those people could regain full body motion. Members of the Neuralink team said they also would like to see the technology permitting the uploading of memories for later use. "Yes, I think in the future you will be able to save and replay memories," Musk said. Neuroscientists not linked to the company said the presentation suggested Neuralink had made great progress with the technology. However, they warned that many more studies will be needed to test the long-term success of such devices. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared its independence from Britain on July 4, 1776. At first, the new nation was a loosely formed alliance governed under the Articles of Confederation. As we described in previous programs, all this changed when a new plan of government, the Constitution, went into effect on March 4, 1789. There was much to be done to make it work. The machinery of government was untested. Strong leadership was needed, and Washington was the man chosen to provide it. Many historians believe there would never have been a United States without George Washington. He led the American people to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. He kept the new nation united in the dangerous first years. Dorothy Moss is the assistant curator of painting and sculpture at the Smithsonian National Portrait Gallery in Washington. She says the painting, known as the Lansdowne Portrait, shows the way many people thought of Washington. It was painted in 1796 as Washington was finishing his presidency. In it, he is standing with one arm extended as if he is speaking to a large group of people. His hair is gray, and he is beginning to go bald. The former general wears formal clothes, but not the uniform of a soldier. Washington was tall but thin. In the portrait, he looks bigger than he was in real life. Curator Dorothy Moss says, in some ways, the portrait shows Washington like a king. But in other ways, she says, he appears like a neighbor or someone you could talk to.
He's shown with a serious expression, a determined look. People at the time commented on his broad jaw, which actually looks that way because he was wearing false teeth. His mouth is clenched, yet he projects a gentle spirit.
During his lifetime, Washington was honored for his courage and wisdom. After his death in 1799, he became almost godlike in the way people respected him. Dorothy Moss says even people in England thought there was something unusually special about George Washington. The British owner of the Lansdowne portrait kept the painting of the American president in his house.
The Marquis of Lansdowne commented that the visitors to his house would stop in reverence to it when they would pass by, that people were stopped in their tracks by it.
And in the United States?
The same reaction.
George Washington represented the spirit of America, what was best about the country. For well over 100 years, Americans found it difficult to criticize him. Modern historians, however, have painted a more realistic picture of Washington. They write about his weaknesses as well as his strengths. Yet this has not reduced his greatness and importance in the making of the nation. The force of Washington's personality and his influence was extremely important at the Philadelphia Convention that wrote the Constitution. Some say the convention would not have been held had he not agreed to attend. Later, as the first president, he gave the nation a good start. Washington was able to control political disputes in the new government. He would not let them damage the nation's unity. Washington often thought of the future. He wanted the first government to take the right steps. Some things may not seem important in the beginning, he said, but later they may have bad, permanent results. It would be better, he felt, to start his administration right than to try to correct mistakes later when it might be too late. He hoped to act in such a way that future presidents could continue to build on what he began. Washington had clear, firm ideas about what was right and what was wrong. He loved justice. He also loved the Republican form of government. Some people had difficulty seeing this part of the man. Washington looked like an aristocrat, and at times he seemed to act like one. He attended many ceremonies. He often rode through the streets in a carriage pulled by six horses. His critics called him king. Washington opposed rule by kings and dictators. He was shocked that some people talked of having a monarchy in America. He was even more shocked that they did not understand the harm they were doing. Washington warned that this loose talk could lead to an attempt to establish a monarchy in the United States. A monarchy, he said, would be a great victory for the enemies of the United States. It would prove that Americans could not govern themselves. As president, Washington decided to do everything in his power to prevent the country from ever being ruled by a king or dictator. He wanted the people to have as much self-government as possible. Such a government, Washington felt, meant a life of personal freedom and equal justice for the people. The 18th century has been described as an age of reason and enlightenment. Washington was a man of his times. He said, "No one could feel a greater interest in the happiness of mankind than he did." He said it was his greatest hope that the policies of that time would bring to everyone those blessings which should be theirs. Washington was especially happy and proud that the United States would protect people against oppression for their religious beliefs. He did not care which god people worshipped. He felt that religious freedom was a right of every person. Good men, he said, are found all over the world. They can be followers of any religion or no religion at all. Washington's feelings about racial oppression were as strong as his feelings about religious oppression. Like others of his time, he owned African slaves. But he expressed a hatred of slavery. "There was not a man alive," he said, "who wished more truly than he did to see an end to slavery. By his order, all his slaves were freed when he died." From the beginning, George Washington was careful to establish a good working relationship with the Congress. He did not attempt to take away any powers given to the Congress by the Constitution. By his actions, he confirmed the separation of powers of the three branches of the government as described in the Constitution. The Congress, too, was ready to cooperate. It did not attempt to take away any powers given to the president by the Constitution. The Congress, for example, agreed that President Washington had the right to appoint members of his administration, but Congress had the right to approve them. Washington asked some of the nation's wisest and most able men to serve in the new government. For Secretary of State, he chose Thomas Jefferson. At the time, Jefferson was America's representative to France. While Congress was considering Jefferson's nomination, Washington had heard of threatening events in France. He learned that a mob had captured the old prison called the Bastille. Washington was worried. The United States had depended on France for help during its war for independence, and it still needed French help. A crisis in France could be bad for America. The information Jefferson brought home would prove valuable if the situation in France got worse. Washington also thought Jefferson's advice would be useful in general, not just on French developments. For Secretary of the Treasury, Washington chose Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had served as one of Washington's aides during the Revolutionary War. For Chief Justice of the United States, he chose John Jay. Jay helped write the Federalist Papers. These are considered the best explanation of the Constitution ever written. Two delegates to the Constitutional Convention were named Associate Justices of the Supreme Court, James Wilson and John Rutledge. For Attorney General, Washington wanted a good lawyer and someone who supported the Constitution. The Attorney General is the nation's top law enforcement official. For that job, Washington chose Edmund Randolph of Virginia. It was Randolph who proposed the Virginia Plan to the Philadelphia Convention. The plan became the basis for the Constitution. Randolph refused to sign the Constitution because he did not believe it could be approved. But later, he worked to help win Virginia's approval of the Constitution. President Washington nominated his cabinet members, and the Congress approved them. The president was ready to begin work on the nation's urgent problems. And there were many. One problem was Spain's control of the lower part of the Mississippi River. American farmers needed to use the river to transport their crops to market. But the Spanish governor in Louisiana closed the Mississippi to American boats. There also were problems with Britain. The United States had no commercial treaty with Britain, and Britain had sent no representative to the new American government. Equally urgent were the new nation's economic problems. Two major issues had to be settled. One was repayment of loans made to support the American army during the Revolution. The other was the creation of a national financial system. Both issues needed quick action. Finding solutions to these issues would be the job of President Washington's Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.